From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. A church sues a state over the right to marry. Domestic employers unite. And a radical experiment in Jewish worship and community. That's what's coming up in the next hour on State of Belief Radio. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you, and we are grateful. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help us keep this show on the air.
We can turn back the tide from ignorance and illiteracy and fundamentalism towards the literate, knowledgeable, compassionate, kind, caring tradition that I know we have.
Organized religion is on the decline in this country, if a number of respected surveys that have come out in the past couple of years are to be believed. I think it's undeniable that things are getting shaken up, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. Yes, right now, a record number of Americans identify as nuns, not affiliated with any denomination. But, you know, this is also a moment of opportunity for those seeking new ways to form spiritual community, including drawing inspiration from different faiths and pursuing meaning in what could perhaps be described as disorganized religion. On the cutting edge of the pursuit of new forms of religious expression is Amichai Lau Lavie, who recently presided at an observance of Passover and Easter called a Last Seder. On this week's show, you'll hear about his attempts to bring relevance to what some consider to be a post-religious generation.
We have always believed that our home is also a workplace, and that those who help us care for our home and our loved ones should receive the same employment package that we have.
As faith-rooted activists have made progress in raising awareness of the plight of many workers in this country, it's been inspiring to see some employers step up and participate in creating fair and just conditions. Now, occasionally this happens at the corporate level. More often, it's a case of individuals taking responsibility for the way they interact with those over whom they exercise economic influence. On this week's show, you're going to meet Danielle Ferris, who, as National Director of Hand in Hand, the Domestic Employers Network, is a leading voice in bringing about needed change in this part of our economy.
These statutes criminalize a minister who performs a religious ceremony, even if the ceremony is not intended to be a legal marriage under state law. That minister's right to the free exercise of religion is violated.
This past week, the United Church of Christ made history by becoming the first denomination in the country to file a lawsuit challenging a state's laws on marriage equality. The state is North Carolina, where clergy can face criminal charges for performing weddings for couples who don't have a marriage license. The problem, of course, is that North Carolina has a constitutional prohibition on same-gender marriage, hence no chance for a license. The church is challenging the state on free exercise of religion grounds. And I'm joined now by the Reverend Dr. J. Bennett Guess. He is the Executive Minister of the United Church of Christ Local Church Ministries. Ben, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Gaddy. It's great to be with you. I'm a great fan of your work and of the work of the Interfaith Alliance.
Well, thank you. I wish you would start by talking a little bit about how the North Carolina lawsuit came to be filed.
Well, this lawsuit came about initially because we had some United Church of Christ clergy and clergy from other denominations in North Carolina who were actually organizing marriage junkets, if you will, where they were renting buses and taking couples from their churches in North Carolina to Washington, D.C., so that these couples could be legally married by their pastors who knew them and loved them and cared about them, and the pastors who wanted to be part of one of the most special events in their prisoners' lives, their marriage. And these clergy and couples began asking, understandably, why should the financial and emotional and physical burden fall to us to have to leave behind our communities of faith, our families behind, our sacred spaces behind, in order to go to a strange, far-off place where these couples could have a religious ceremony, but without their community of faith, without their families there with them, and in keeping with the faith and order of the United Church of Christ. It just didn't make sense to them. And add to that, North Carolina's Amendment 1 not only outlaws same-gender marriage, but also civil unions and domestic partnerships. So the state law actually made it illegal, a first-degree criminal misdemeanor, for clergy to perform a marriage ceremony for any couple, as you said, regardless of gender, if they do not possess a state license. We believe that clergy person should not have to choose between offering pastoral care and religious services to their parishioners and breaking the law, which is what North Carolina is asking our clergy to choose between.
To do. I know that some listener to this program is going to write me or call our listener line and say, you are always talking about the importance of separation of church and state, and now here is a church that's suing a state. So how does the United Church of Christ deal with that? I want you to answer that so I'll know how to answer it.
Well, that is a good question. And marriage is a complicated issue because it has both religious implications and it has legal implications. And we're at a place in this country where we probably need to decide whether we're going to separate those two and whether people are going to get married in places of worship and then separately go to a courthouse to get a legal license. Some of us might say that's the way to resolve this and get the churches out of the legal marrying business. But right now, our laws are intertwined and clergy act as agents of the state. We have some clergy, many clergy, including myself, have signed a pledge to refuse to do any legal marriages for heterosexual couples until all couples have the freedom to marry. We are at a place where this issue of the restriction of clergy to be able to perform their religious duties by the state is particularly troubling, and that's why we're taking this issue to court in North Carolina. It's really a double standard. The state is saying that it is permissible for religious organizations to do marriages as long as they prescribe to the kinds of marriages that the state of North Carolina, I think, are permissible, while the United Church of Christ has long held to the equality of lesbian and gay people, and it is within the religious tenets of our denomination and other denominations as well that we do these types of religious ceremonies. The law in North Carolina also says that even beyond marriage, the semblance of marriage, a religious ceremony that looks like a marriage, if it doesn't have a license, that too is illegal. So the state is not just intervening on our rights to do marriages, but our rights to do religious services. The shocking news here for some people is that gay and lesbians can also be committed religious people.
Yeah.
Who have a belief system that is important to them, that we can be committed and active in our places of worship, that we have people in our communities of faith that we love and clergy that are important to us, and we don't want to have to leave all that behind in order to have a legal marriage in another place and in another state. It's been interesting for me to read legal analysts who are swooning over the brilliant legal strategy of the United Church of Christ to turn the religious freedom argument upside down. Mm-hmm. But I have to tell you, that was not our initial motivation. The initial motivation for us was really that the United Church of Christ has a lot of gay and lesbian people in our congregations, and we want those people to be fully members of our churches and receive the same pastoral care and religious services that we would provide to any other member. Yeah. And we think to deny them that full access to be a part of our faith community, is to deny our church from fully being the kind of church we espouse to be. It limits the United Church of Christ from our free exercise of our religious tenets, which are rooted in a radical inclusive gospel, the radical inclusion that we see lived out in the life of Jesus.
Yeah. Talk a minute about the couples that have been wanting to go to D.C. to get married because they can do that there, and why this is so important to them in North Carolina.
I think that's a very important question. On Monday, when we filed the case, we had a press conference, and as a part of that press conference, we had a number of clergy, many from the United Church of Christ, but also a rabbi from the Reformed Jewish tradition, a Lutheran pastor, a UU pastor, and each one of those stood and talked about couples that were important to them within their congregations. And many of our plaintiffs are couples who are active members in faith communities. And they, too, spoke to reporters there about what their church means to them, what their community of faith means to them, what their pastor means to them, and how they long to have a marriage ceremony in their hometown with their pastor, with their clergy, in that beautiful sacred space that they love so much. And while they were grateful that they had the opportunity to go to another state to get married, as religious people, they feel that their free exercise of religion is being trampled upon.
Are there other religious groups or leaders participating in the lawsuit, or is it at this point just the UCC?
The United Church of Christ is the lead plaintiff, and we are the only denomination tied to the case. But we do have clergy and couple plaintiffs that are representing the UCC, Reformed Judaism, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and Unitarian Universalism. Mm-hmm. We also have heard from other faith traditions since we have filed this, and we anticipate that some other faith communities might come on board with us, and certainly we expect the faith communities might be a party in terms of filing an amicus brief. I think it's important that regardless of where people stand on the issue of marriage equality, that even people in conservative religious traditions, they could equally be troubled by the ways in which the state is telling clergy who they can and cannot bless and what kind of religious services they can or cannot do. It's particularly troubling. And as a church of the pilgrims, the people who are the successor denomination of those people who came to this country so celebratedly around the free exercise of religion, we like to say we know how to be good Americans. And as good Americans, we think it's important that we stand up on this issue of equal rights pertaining to the free exercise of religion.
Ben, can our listeners keep up with the case on the website at the UCC?
They sure can. You can go to ucc.org/IDO, which is short for I Do Stand for Religious Freedom. They can find us at the hashtag Free Religion. And also on our website, you'll find background to the case, who the plaintiffs are, ways in which people can get involved and help promote this free exercise of religion movement that we're talking about.
You know, I'm so glad that you all understand that free religion is a redundancy. And I wish more people understood that. Ben, you're an ordained minister. You're a married gay man. How has that personal experience informed your work on this issue? When you see this case, this isn't just a case. It's more than that, isn't it? What is it to you?
Well, thank you for that question, because as an openly gay man who is married, I've been in a long-term committed relationship with my partner for 13 years, so it is personal. But it's also personal because I've been a minister for almost 25 years, and I don't know which aspect of my life is more offended by North Carolina's marriage laws, the part that would criminalize me and my spouse's relationship, or the part that would try to relegate me as clergy to second-class status and try to interfere with my ability to bless loving couples that come to me and would seek that blessing. It is a thrilling moment in the life of our country in which we are seeing changes all around us, and it is our hope in the United Church of Christ that we will continue to move toward greater justice for all people, including lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people.
The Reverend Dr. J. Bennett Guess is Executive Minister of the United Church of Christ Local Church Ministries. On Monday, the denomination sued the state of North Carolina over the state's ban on same-gender marriage, arguing that it infringes on UCC clergy's right to freedom of religious expression. Ben, as someone who is very, very tired of the monopoly the religious right has seemed to have on the language of ethics and religious freedom, I am so appreciative of the action that you and your denomination are taking on this, and you're welcome on State of Belief Radio to update us anytime. We want to know how this comes out.
Well, we would welcome that opportunity, and we will prayerfully be about the next few weeks and months as we await the court's decision. And we thank you for the opportunity to come back again and update your listeners about what's happening.
Danielle Ferris is National Director at Hand in Hand, the Domestic Employers Association. Her work is contributing to positive change in many lives, often for some of the most vulnerable among us. And I am delighted to welcome her now to State of Belief Radio. Danielle, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Would you mind just summarizing the work of Hand in Hand?
Hand in Hand, the Domestic Employers Network, is a network of families and individuals who employ domestic workers. So that's nannies, house cleaners, home attendants for people with disabilities and seniors. And we work together with the National Domestic Workers Alliance to transform the industry so it works for everyone. So we come together because employers believe that dignified and fair working conditions benefit both domestic workers and those who employ them.
How long have you been doing the work?
We're pretty new. We were founded in 2010, and our work grows out of work at Jews for Racial and Economic Justice.
Mm-hmm.
Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, JFRED, has organized employers of domestic workers since 2002 and supported domestic workers who passed the first ever Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, which is a law passed in New York State in 2010. So we grow out of that work.
That's
and now
great.
We're national, and we work with many different communities.
And you're based on the West Coast?
I am based in Oakland. We have on-the-ground work happening in California and New York State, and we also do work throughout the country. And the National Domestic Workers Alliance has affiliates where workers are organizing in 40 locations across the country.
I know that you're aware that in recent months, activists and leaders from across a broad spectrum of faith traditions and issues have been remarkably consistent in presenting economic justice as a foundation for almost any other kind of progress in our nation. And that's why hearing about your work immediately got my attention. Talk, if you will, please, Danielle, about this idea of the foundational nature of economic justice.
Domestic workers, mostly women, right now mostly immigrant women of color, do the work we say that makes all other work possible. So they work in people's homes, allowing their employers to go to work and mm-hmm. keep this country running. And so we really believe that all of us, the workers and the families who employ them, need to have economic security in order to have all of our communities thrive. And so, you know, just to give some context, the domestic work industry in specific was left out of many labor laws in this country.
Yeah.
And because of that, there's very few guidelines. And so that means that egregious abuse situations can happen, and even slave-like situations. That's the problem. On the other side, there are a vast majority of employers who really want to do the right thing, and they see how providing well for the workers in their homes is really also good for their families, and they want to do that. And then there are no guidelines. And so our work, we are launching a new campaign called My Home is Someone's Workplace, which really aims to bring that out of the shadows, bring the conversation into the public eye, and support employers who want to do the right thing, know that it's better off for everyone in the equation when workers have economic security and are treated well, and want guidance and support about how to do that.
There's a distinction, I think, that is an important one for our listeners to understand. I know Hand in Hand is an association of domestic employers. And why is the distinction important as opposed to an association of workers?
The National Domestic Workers Alliance is an alliance of workers, and that's very important. Workers really understand their own experience and are experts in the industry and have been leading the movement for rights and justice for domestic workers, a really inspiring movement. The important thing about also having an organization of employers is that we know that it will take all of us to transform this industry. And so we work very closely with the workers, but we are an organization of employers. And just to bring out, you know, why an organization of employers, I'll tell a brief story.
Okay.
In 2006, I was at a gathering with employers of house cleaners and nannies in the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And a woman named Judith came, and she just came because her friend had invited her. And we started the conversation about her experience being raised by a nanny, then employing a nanny, then employing a house cleaner, now considering elder care for her husband. And she started to cry in the middle of the conversation. And, you know, when asked why, she said, you know, I wasn't sure why I came. But now that I'm here, I realize these women workers have been so central to my life and so central to my family's lives. And meanwhile, I'm at the mailbox whispering with my neighbors about how to figure out, you know, what to pay them and if I should give a bonus and all of these decisions that are key to their livelihood. And she realized she was holding a ton of anxiety about the fact that she had these important relationships but didn't know how to build them in such a way that reflected her values.
Mm-hmm.
And so she is now a leader in Hand in Hand in Jews for Racial and Economic Justice and lead in bringing this issue actually to her synagogue. She's now brought together seniors in her synagogue to talk about how can we build with the elder care workers in our community in such a way that reflects our Jewish values. So that's an example where the workers need to do their good work of educating workers about their rights, leading campaigns to call for more rights, and then Hand in Hand needs to do the work of bringing together communities that depend on these workers and supporting employers to have the important conversations in our community.
I really was taken with the comments that you make, the benefits for the employer that come from dealing fairly with workers. And that is, I don't think that's just a methodology to make people feel good. You really are trying to get employers to see there's something very good about dealing fairly with the workers. Explain that for our people, because I think that is an extremely important part of what needs to be understood.
Definitely not just a methodology. Employers tell us their stories every day about this, and there's many different reasons why employers see the benefit for them. There's a woman named Donna in Brooklyn, New York, who has two daughters. And she got connected to us through programming in the Hebrew school of her synagogue, where they brought together the parents and the children to talk about child caregivers in the homes of those children and appreciating them and showing them value. And, you know, she was really struck that day by the fact that she was trying to model for her daughters what being respectful meant in so many areas of her life. And then she realized, if I don't figure out what it means to be respectful of the child care provider I employ to help care for my children, then I'm not actually going to be modeling for them what mm-hmm. respect looks like. And so for her, you know, she was bringing them to Hebrew school, wanted them to have a Jewish education, wanted them to take on Jewish values and social justice, and yet she didn't know what that meant in her own home. And so she has also gotten very involved to learn, how can I build that relationship in a way that will model that for my daughters and have them growing up knowing what respect looks like. So there's so many benefits. I think people really feel on both a practical level, if I don't provide sick days for the worker, they're going to come to work and get my family sick. It's
mm-hmm.
a very, you know, material benefit. And then on the other hand, these workers are in the most intimate parts of people's lives, caring for children, supporting people with disabilities to get up in the morning, take showers. And when we have really good, mutually respectful, positive relationships, it's so visceral. We
yeah.
know that our homes are going to feel better. And I think employers really come to know that, and then they want to know, how do I do that? And that's where Hand in Hand hopes to come in.
It seems to me like, if I'm understanding correctly, that to become involved in Hand in Hand is also to become involved in multifaceted areas of work. Am I right that this takes you into one-on-one education, it takes you into politics, it takes you into government policies, it takes you into economic ethics, all of those things involved in what you're doing?
Absolutely. That's a great articulation. We have seen the success of workers and employers coming together, first with the New York Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, then in the California Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. We know that we need to do the one-on-one support. We also know that communities need to shift the conversation and change cultural norms. We need faith congregations to step up and say, we're going to value this labor that's remained invisible for so long. We also know that the problem cannot sit on individuals. So while Judith and Donna were at home figuring everything out for themselves, while workers are isolated and at times facing abuses, we do need to call on all of us to make change in those homes that are also workplaces. But part of My Home is Someone's Workplace is also recognizing that there is policy change that needs to happen here. And we really see so many different issues connecting to this. So while we work together on the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, we also work together on immigration reform so that domestic workers can live here safely and not be threatened to deportation. We also know that there is not enough support in this country around child care, around in-home support for seniors and people with disabilities. And so we also need to continue to work towards more funding and support for our families getting the care and support that we need. So we are working on all of those levels and inviting employers to pledge to fair practices, then supporting them through resources and programming that supports them to figure out how to be a fair employer. And then we invite folks into policy campaigns to change so many different elements of our society that are needed to transform the industry for everyone.
That's really great work. Danielle, tell us how people can keep up with you, look over your shoulder, get more information on the organization. How should they do that?
We just launched a new website that is chock full of resources. It's domesticemployers.org, domesticemployers.org. So anyone who employs a domestic worker can check out our resources there. There's also information about campaigns. You can sign up, stay in touch. If there's domestic workers out there looking to get involved, there's another website for the National Domestic Workers Alliance. That's domesticworkers.org.
Danielle Ferris is National Director at Hand in Hand, the Domestic Employers Association. Danielle, this is really important work. I know that it's the kind of work that gets done not just so you can have a paycheck, but because you have a passion about it. We're glad you were with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate all of your work.
Recently, readers of the New York Times were introduced to Lab Shul, an experimental Jewish gathering taking place in what the paper called a pop-up synagogue. Leading this experiment in Jewish spirituality is rabbinical student Amichai Lowell Levy, and I am so happy to have him join us right now on State of Belief Radio. Amichai, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us about Lab Shul. The Times quote you as saying the project is still in the beta stage, so tell us what that means too.
Lab Shul is an artist-driven congregation that was created over the last few years by a whole bunch of us who were seeking a new way to worship, to study, to experiment with the sacred. We all come from Jewish backgrounds and very different backgrounds. And we wanted an experience that is aesthetic and sophisticated and speaks to who we are today, people across the spectrum of 20s to 50s. And we, like many others, recognize that the current offering of many religions don't quite speak to the zeitgeist of the digital and the disconnected and the eager. Mm-hmm. So Lab Shul is an expression of all these expressions. It's a way to try out old things and reinvent the synagogue for the 21st century.
Is it a congregation that gathers physically, or is it a congregation that gathers technologically, or is it both?
It is all of the above. We go by the pop-up model, which means we do have events going on in New York City, which is our home base. We don't use an actual brick-and-mortar sanctuary. We go to different places, a winery, a gallery, museum, school, so we can be in different areas and reach different audiences. We do quite a bit online. I just completed a pre-Passover training course via a webinar. We have a lot of interaction with people on different digital outlets. But at the end of the day, we want to be together. Mm-hmm. We feel that what spirituality has to offer the digital age is hand-holding and singing and being in the same place.
You recently organized an observance that was called the Last Seder, and I've been eager to ask about that.
We have about 2,000 to 3,000 people joining us on the Jewish high holidays, and we have a few hundred joining us once a month for our Shabbat programs. A lot of those people are from interfaith families, whether they are Jewish and Christian, Jewish and Muslim, et cetera, and other. And we feel called to create programs that really speak to who we are. So we wanted to create a Passover Easter program that honors both holidays, honors spring, finds a mutual narrative between the two holidays. And it so happened that we were on Holy Saturday, and that for the Passover week, this was the moment in which the Hebrews would have been on the shores of the Sea of Reeds. So we co-created a narrative which was about waiting for the news about Jesus and waiting for figuring out how to cross the sea, and working with various leaders from the Christian faith and a bunch of us from the Jewish faith, we created a musical worship and a storytelling ritual that invited both congregations and a lot of guests to wait with us on the shores. It was a very powerful Saturday morning. We had about 200 people. And we're very moved.
Amichai, you come from a long line of Jewish religious leaders, I understand. How does that inform the work that you're doing today?
Well, I would say that I'm very privileged to have been born into a family that is very Jewishly knowledgeable and literate and carries the legacy of generations. With that responsibility, I feel the need to share these privileges with others who are seeking a way into Judaism, a way that is inclusive, that is celebratory, that is universal, that is positive. And with that legacy of very orthodox and at times rigid Judaism, I want to reach a new generation where we're more flexidox or polydox than orthodox, more welcoming of other people of faith, more welcoming of other sexual choices, certainly egalitarian. So in this relay race, I feel I've inherited this rabbinic baton, and I am owning it, and I want to pass it on with new sensitivities.
Is this, when you talk about relating tradition to modernity and taking into account the changes that have gone on for all of us in religion, is it a matter of substance that's different, or is it a matter of style, or is it a methodology? In other words, is it a change in theology, or is it a change in ritual and practice?
I think it must be all of the above to some degree. We at Labshul have a tagline, beyond artist-driven, a pop-up, and everyone-friendly, we also have God-optional, which we sometimes substitute for BYOG, bring your own God. And when we use liturgy, we use a gender-neutral version of God. We talk about the divine in very post-feminist and modern and open ways that lets everybody feel the sense of spirit in a way that she or he can really relate to. So on the one hand, this is marketing talk. On the other hand, this is deeply theological. For what is the process theology that we are now dealing with? That has to do with how we read scripture, with how we open people to pray. At the core of where we are in the 21st century is an invitation to reimagine what we've inherited and make it accessible. That also means changing some of the hard drive and some of the hard concepts that are at the core of the mythology and the vocabulary.
Isolate, if you will, for me, some of the elements in your work that you would see as specific to your own life experiences and to being in New York City in 2014.
Interesting. Well, Labshul started off as a theater company called Storytelling that was founded 15 years ago by myself and a bunch of wonderful artists. And our goal was to take the stories of Scripture and position them as interactive theater so that there will be more biblical literacy and more empowerment to challenge status quo. So out of the theater company emerged a congregation. Every time we create this sophisticated alternative arena for worship, we are guided by these theatrical concepts. And we're in New York City, which is a theater town. So we are really careful in the aesthetic and the consistent feel of the suspension of disbelief when we create a container for spiritual experience. So the way we tell Scripture is still modified by our methodology, which is very theatrical and interactive, but it's not a performance. Everybody is in it. Mm-hmm. Those elements are very critical to us.
How do you treat the idea of Israel as the chosen people?
Ooh, landmine. I'll share with you my honest personal view on this. I think, like many things that we've inherited that must be looked at carefully, I think the chosen notion has been with us as a protective shield for thousands of years, and I'm not convinced that it's our best shield moving forward.
I see.
I think we're chosen with other people. In fact, one of the liturgy changes we've made is when people chant the blessing as we enter the Torah, the scriptural element of our worship, the traditional blessing is thanking God for having chosen us from other people. And we've made a tiny shift that says for having chosen us with other people. Honoring all traditions, honoring all the faith, grateful and proud of our legacy, but we are just one seat at the table.
When did the dime drop? When did the light come on? And you say, I've got to get in this search for new forms of religious expression in a community setting.
Well, I think a bunch of dimes dropped over the years, but I would say one of the main ones was when I was in my late teens. And I realized that, and to be honest with myself, I need to come out as a gay man. Back in Israel in the 80s, it was not as easy as it is today. And I was looking at the Bible. I grew up as a religious Jew, and I thought, there's a mistake here. Either the book is wrong and God is wrong, or I'm wrong, and I didn't feel wrong. So I was looking for a way to reconcile who I thought I was becoming with who I was groomed to become. And that was what caused me to take a closer look at the Bible and look at commentary and the oral tradition and understand that there are 70 facets to Torah and that there are many ways of expressing one's love of God and religion and that I'm not necessarily of the Orthodox kind. And I will need to spend my life finding new solutions and creative alternatives. And it's been that way ever since.
So these experiments in organized religion, we probably should put a sticker on it that says could be dangerous, because I can't imagine that you start looking at these experiments and not risk major change in your own life.
I think the main change is the expansion of vulnerability. And what I am so humbled by again and again, and with our shift from theater to worship, is that we offer ourselves and other people the safe container, a sanctuary, to be vulnerable. And that's dangerous.
Yes.
Because that's real. That's emotions. Every time I'm there helping to co-lead these performance events and these moments of worship, I cry. And if I don't cry, I feel like I didn't do my job. And I cry because it's from the heart, and I allow other people to be in this vulnerable place. And that's dangerous because it's real. And if we wouldn't be doing that, then we're just chewing and churning old words that our ancestors gave us and do a checklist on are you religious and go home. Been there, done that.
Okay, what would you like to see Labshul evolve into?
I really want us to go from the model that people know of having a rabbi and a cantor and a teacher and a presenter to a real circle of co-creators. We already have some of it, but I want more of it. So we understand, all of us, the responsibility and the role we have in being there for each other and creating a robust community that can stand up to the challenges of modern times.
Tell us, if you will, how our listeners can learn more about this whole movement and what you're doing with this very creative approach to religion.
Please check us online, www.labshul.org. We blog constantly. We invite people to contribute, to join us, to support us. We are very young, and we hope to grow to be still young and very old.
Amichai Lau-Lavi is a rabbinical student who brings all of his diverse life experience to the task of creating new forms of community and worship in a Jewish and interreligious context. Amichai, thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio today, and thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you very much. Peace and a great spring.
Now, I have a few words to share before we go today. The dominant story on race in this week's news has been extremely disturbing. However, it's also enlightening. Nurturing race relations in this nation still has a long way to go. Remember that the disgusting racial slurs that we heard from the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers basketball team were a part of a thought-to-be-private conversation in his own house and no knowledge of the conversation being recorded. He probably wouldn't have said that in public. In recent years, even prejudiced, even bigoted people have embraced a kind of etiquette of race that silences the most ridiculous forms of rhetorical racism. Of course, that doesn't exempt what the owner said from valid criticism. It only demonstrates the extreme to which some people's racial hatred goes when they are free and completely honest with someone. Yes, such talk is sickening, but it is reality. So much work on race relations is yet to be done. Now, like others, I applauded the judgment of the head of the National Basketball Association, Mr. Silver. Yes, he brought the hammer down hard to banish the owner, Donald Sterling, from NBA games and to demand that he sell the team he owns are tough penalties. The fine of $2.5 million is like a quarter for the owner, whose team is reported to be worth almost $1 billion. But let's be sure that we acknowledge something positive here, something that happened that needs to be affirmed. We saw the results quickly of impassioned activism. The leader of the NBA had his agenda set for him by activist NBA players and coaches, sports writers, and basketball fans all across this nation. Tweets were plentiful. Personal opinions were shared with enthusiasm. No one looking at the reactions to the team's owners' racist statements had any doubt about the kind of harsh punishment that had to be handed down to prevent insurrection or work stoppages or demonstrations and all the other. Within a 3-day period, an ugly situation was dealt with decisively, and the perpetrator of bigotry was robbed of his position of power and of the public airwaves that carried his message of ignorance and exclusion. Just look, folks, look what the public can do when we're motivated. Think of the other dimensions of race relations that also need such public support for change. Tougher gun control laws, more attention to public education, welfare reform, economic justice, and the list goes on and on and on. Now, as the president of a nonprofit organization, I also took note of the caution with which we have to go after money that we badly need. The NAACP of Los Angeles had planned to present a Lifetime Achievement Award to the rich owner who was a bigot. Outsiders didn't understand that. What are they giving the award for, was the question. Leaders of the NAACP rightly decided to give back the money they had received from this donor whose life itself was a contradiction to all that the NAACP works for. Folks, no matter how badly we need money in the nonprofit world, we cannot forfeit the principles of our mission in order to garner a generous contribution to our budget. Donald Sterling woke up a nation this week. Our eyes were opened wide enough that we could see ugliness and promise both at the same time. All of us were forced to examine our language, our thoughts, our actions. Every word counts. A man that seemed to be, from a distance, at the center of facilitating racial justice and supporting a basketball league that is 80% African American, was at heart a racist opposing all that he seemed to support. Racism has not gone away in this nation, though often it has gone into hiding. But that doesn't mean it's gone away. It's still there. Watch and listen and respond to others whose expressions merit denunciation and the lack of a medium through which to speak. Celebrate the power of activism and concentrate on how such power can come from instant collaboration and honest demands for getting rid of what's wrong. We cannot allow money earned or money given, to confuse us about our moral and civil responsibilities of working for a just society devoid of rabid incivility. What a week this one was. Both the bad and the good of the week can happen again. For one, I hope that again the good prevails. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear from listeners across the country who say they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that they simply can't find anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. I hope you'll stay in touch with us throughout the week. You can do that on Facebook and Twitter. Our listener line is 202-681-4246. And as always, we encourage you to tell other people about this show. Encourage them to listen to it so that all of us can be engaged in the same conversation about what's right and what's wrong in this nation and what to do about it. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man, you see.